PPIP, it's fun to say, but will it play? Good morning, I'm Mike Pesca for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. PPIP is an acronym for the Public-Private Investment Plan. You know, the huge distressed asset plan. Distressed assets, we used to call them toxic assets. Now we're actually calling them legacy assets. It's all very confusing with the added bonus that the fate of capitalism could depend on it. Dan Gross of Newsweek and the Big Money is here. Hey, Dan, how are you?
Morning, Mike. How are you?
First of all, before we get to this PPIP, and I'm well, thank you. I don't want to ignore your question. I want to ask you about the stress test, which is, I think, what the government is running to figure out how much stress some banks can take. Can you tell me how that's going and what the process is like?
I think the process is they send examiners in, teams of examiners, to look at banks, their books, you know, what their loans are doing, how they're performing, et cetera. And then they run various scenarios. You know, if the economy shrinks by X percent and unemployment rises to Y percent, what would be the impact on their book of loans? What would be the losses they'd expect to take? And the idea is to give the regulators a sense of how well these banks can survive on their own. Will they need more government assistance? Will they make it on their own? Now, no one is going to fail this stress test. This is like something out of Lake Wobegon, where everybody will score above average.
Right.
They're not going to say, you failed, therefore you're dead. They're going to say, if it looks like you're in big trouble or you could be in trouble, we will provide you with some more capital.
So is it a dog and pony show, or can actual real information be gleaned from it?
I think we can get real information from this. You know, there's been a sense throughout when the TARP was passed back in last September of a lack of transparency, that this was sort of an ad hoc, you know, non-systemic thing. You know, we did a deal with this bank and then a deal with this bank, and then we, you know, within a matter of weeks put out a couple hundred billion dollars, that there wasn't a great deal of method behind what was done. So this is an attempt, I think, to impose some kind of method as to how this is going to work out going forward, to sort of not be arbitrary about, you know, why one bank gets a certain amount of money and another one doesn't, why the feds might decide that one bank really needs it, even if, you know, the management doesn't think they do.
Now, TARP, does the T in TARP stand for Troubled as in Troubled Asset Relief Program, or is it toxic? Do you know what
it was originally
is?
Troubled.
Troubled. So first it was troubled, then it was toxic. Now we call them legacy assets. But what the TARP and this PPIP program is meant to address are those troubled or toxic or legacy assets that the banks have on their books and can't sell. How is this thing going to work, and how are they going to get them to be sold or to have a market for these troubled assets?
Well, this has been the issue right from the beginning, since, you know, probably a year ago after Bear Stearns failed, this growing realization that these banks, large and small, and in particular the large ones, had accumulated gazillions of dollars, that's a technical term used in the stress test, of mortgage debt, of mortgage-related assets that were going bad at a pretty rapid rate. If you are a bank, it's really poisonous to have assets going bad, because every quarter you have to mark them to market, tell investors what they're worth. If they decline in value, you have to take a hit against your earnings. So as long as they continue to go down, it continually makes it seem like you have less capital than you think you have, and it's kind of this death spiral that they've gotten into.
Right. So they're terrible anchors, and now the plan is, all right, someone's going to buy these anchors.
The original plan, when they passed the TARP in September, was we will buy, the government's going to take the $700 billion Congress appropriated, and we'll buy the assets. That turned out not to be operative, because they quickly realized that if they paid the price that they were actually worth at the time, it would require the banks to mark them down much lower than they were carrying them. So they bought it for 100, the bank said they're worth 80, and the government said, well, you know, we'll buy it at 30 because that's what the market's bearing. If they actually did that at that time, it would have required them to take huge hits. So they quickly transitioned to saying, okay, we'll put capital into the banks, help them weather the storm. Two quarters have passed, and they still have a lot of those bad assets on their books. And it's still the same issue that you had at the beginning, which is the market, dysfunctional as it is, has put a price on a lot of these assets, which is much lower than the banks think it is worth and than the banks want them to be worth. So it's like trying to, you know, imagine if you had to unload your condo in Las Vegas in this market. You might think that if you held on to it for 3 or 4 years, you'd get a better price, but you really need to sell today. You're going to dump it into this glutted market where there are no buyers and nobody has any credit. You're going to get a horrific price for it. That's the challenge they've had right since September, and this latest plan, the PPIP, is intended to remedy that. And the next question is?
The next question is, how's it going?
Well, it's getting slow to get off the ground. The theory was you have these hedge funds out there, private equity firms, opportunity funds, vulture funds, whatever you want to call them, who are in the business of buying up distressed assets. But they don't have access to much credit, and for them, a lot of deals on investments only make sense if they can leverage up their investment. And there's also some sort of concern about the way rules are changing. So the theory was, if we go to these private firms and say, you put in, you know, say, $10, the government will match those $10, and we will lend you another $80.
Right, and that is not just a hypothetical. I mean, the numbers work out that they will lend you up to, you know, 84% of your investment. You put up $8, the government puts up $8, and then they're lending you 84% of your investment. So there's a lot of upside and not too much downside, it would seem.
Exactly. So the most they could lose, I think it actually works out to like 6 or 7%. So you put $6 or $7 down, government puts in $6 or $7, you borrow the other 80-something from the government. It's non-recourse debt, which means if you end up defaulting on that debt, they can't come after you personally. So the most they can lose is the cash that they're putting in, which is a small amount.
Right.
And they have to share their returns, not on a one-to-one basis, but the taxpayers will get a chunk of the returns because we're putting in cash and we're putting in all this debt. And so the theory is that by providing them, essentially bribing them to take this risk or providing them with the means to take out more risk than they otherwise would be willing to, that more people will come out of the woodwork and, you know, they will be maybe perhaps willing to pay a higher price than they would if they were just simply using their own cash, that you would get bidders, multiple bidders on pools of assets, which would drive the price up and create a market for that. So that's the theory.
Now, what's interesting is that when the plan was announced, the market liked it when Treasury Secretary Geithner actually laid out what the plan would be. It was the term seemed so beneficial to the hedge funds and vulture funds who could invest in it that Joseph Stiglitz, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist, wrote an op-ed saying this is insanely beneficial for these private equity guys, and it's really a bad deal for the public. You wrote an op-ed in Slate saying it's such a good deal, I want in on it personally, and yet I'm reading now that the markets, after it was announced today, they're not so hot about this plan. What has happened?
I think we've seen this cycle where every time Washington announced it's going to give kind of free money to Wall Street, investors get really excited.
Figure that.
And then as the reality settles in that this alone will not solve this mega problem we have with our financial sector, they start to get bummed about it and then ask for more free money. Now, ironically, and thank you for mentioning that Slate column, if you look at today's New York Times on the front page, there is an article about how the government is kind of making efforts to do just what I had suggested, which is to set up mutual funds and other types of investment vehicles available to small individual investors that would allow them to get in on this. They're calling it kind of the equivalent of what Liberty bonds were. But, you know, to get away from the sense that we are kind of subsidizing fat cats to take care of the problems that other fat cats created, they may be creating some vehicles that would allow people like you and me to participate.
This is Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're speaking with Dan Gross of Newsweek about some of the programs maybe to get distressed assets off the book. The books, let's take a step back. Does capitalism really depend on it? If this program works, is it going to turn the economy around? And if it fails, are we going to be mired in a terrible recession for many, many more years to come?
No, I don't think capitalism rests on this. The big banks, the future of the big banks and the really big banks rest on this. What we've had, you know, we talk about this financial crisis, a banking crisis. there's no question that a lot of banks are failing, and many already have, mostly small ones. But, you know, that's what happens when you have a deep recession. That's part of capitalism, the failure of companies. And the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, is actually quite good at handling failure. It's got this deposit fund. They go in, they make sure everyone gets paid, et cetera. The problem we have is with a handful of truly giant firms, Citigroup, AIG, that the existing system can't handle their failure.
Yeah.
And so while many banks other than Citigroup would benefit from these types of programs we're talking about, the fact that we have to talk about it on a scale of this size is because you have Citigroup, Bank of America, and a few other really giant institutions that really can't get out of their own way.
So this is the concept of too big to fail, and it's a real concept. There really are a lot of banks, a few banks, that are, in your opinion, too big to fail.
Absolutely.
Now, before you made an allusion to the market originally liking this and then perhaps souring on it or wanting more free government money, could we get out of this mode? Because it seems to me that the news media, the business press, the elite liberal media, middle class Republican media, whatever you want to call it, react to the one day market story whenever the government announces a plan. And if the Dow Jones goes up, we report it like, ah, good government strategy. And we know not to do it, but we keep doing it. Why is that, Dan?
Well, part of it is, the 24-hour news cycle. Part of it is that CNBC, which drives a lot of this coverage and a lot of the sort of debate about this, always has this attitude that Wall Street is kind of rendering a up and down opinion of what's happening in Wall Street and the administration and President Obama's presidency, on a minute-to-minute basis, and you can't help but fall into that trap a bit. Another is that, this is topic A, and it's not just topic A for the business press, it's topic A for the political press, which is really unequipped to deal with it. I'm always shocked when I look and see my colleagues in the White House press corps and the just the ignorance of the questions that they ask. They don't understand these issues, and they haven't taken the time to educate themselves on it. So they're looking for they just want it to be over so they can move on to other things. So there's the sense that, okay, this is the thing that's going to solve it.
Right, and they get
always looking for it.
And they get the Dow Jones going up as a one-day referendum. They wipe the sweat off their brow, and they go on to something else.
Exactly.
Now, I want to mention another big, possibly confusing, even I glaze over thing, and that's the mark-to-market rules. And I bring them up not because they're this huge ratings grabber, but because it seems, again, that a fairly arcane rule change would have great impact on, the future of capitalism. And to summarize, a lot of these assets that you were talking about, the old rule was that the banks would just have to list them, their value, as what the market would pay. And if the market wasn't paying anything, the banks were sitting there looking a lot poorer than they would argue they were. But the change in the mark-to-market rule say that they could now list the assets as what the banks essentially think they're worth. Do you think that changing that rule to allow the banks to mark their assets as to what they think they're worth or what they hope that they're worth, is that a good change? Did we need that now? Because once again, the market liked that change.
I'm sort of two minds about this. On the one hand, it's an insane idea because you're basically telling people, let's pretend. I mean, you have when you have a mutual fund and it owns stocks, it owns IBM and GE, et cetera, so you can go in and any minute say exactly what that mutual fund is worth because the market's telling you exactly what IBM and GE are worth at any given time. And with mark-to-market, you are effectively saying it's as if your mutual fund manager said, well, I know the market says IBM is only at 50. But, my research and my gut tells me that it's actually an $80 stock. And if the market just weren't so irrational, it would recognize that. So I really want, you to act as if the stock is at 80 and pay me, for the performance I'm delivering by having picked a stock that's worth $80. That's, in effect, what mark-to-market is doing. It's saying, we've got all these assets. The market surrounding them has become, you know, irrationally pessimistic and dysfunctional. And so any values and prices you get in them can't be trusted. We have this mortgage, you know, maybe someone's paying it. Even though someone's paying it, you know, it should be, the model says, it should be worth 80 cents. But if we had to sell it today, or there's some index that's tracking these types of mortgages, says it's only worth 40 cents. And if we're not planning on selling it today, if we're going to hold it for a few years and continue to collect mortgage payments, why should we have to say and come out that it's really only worth, you know, half of what we think it's worth and what will be worth to our shareholders in the long term, especially when the act of marking those down will make our financial situation look really bad. And so, you know, there is something to that, the sense that the market has gotten really dislocated, really irrational surrounding a lot of these things. I'm just not so sure as an investor I would feel better that my bank is basically, you know, that the company that I own stock in is basically sort of saying, well, I know the market says this, but I have my own ideas about what these are worth, and that's what we're going to tell people.
Yeah, and by the way, it might be in my interest to kind of exaggerate how much they're worth. Is there no middle ground between what you call, let's just make up a number, and what the current rule is, or what the rule was, which is let's count it as zero? It seems like zero or sky high. Those are our two choices.
Well, you know, the issue is whether a lot of these loans and mortgage securities that the companies have that are going bad are ones they never intended to hold on to, right? The whole model, if you were a big investment bank, was you amassed tons of mortgages and loans, and then you chopped them up and sold them, you know, immediately, and that's how you made your money. What happened was when the market broke down, they got stuck with all the stuff that they couldn't sell. You know, if your business is amassing the stuff and selling it, and you're sort of telegraphing to the world that that's what you do, then it makes a little more sense to market to market. If your business is what's called a portfolio lender, which is, you know, the old savings and loan model, Mike, you make a loan to me, you hold it for 30 years, and expect to profit as I pay it down over the next 30 years, there you could make the case that maybe it doesn't make sense to market to market because your business model, your operating assumption is that you are going to collect payments from me, you know, once a month for the next 30 years. And if I have been current and I'm not showing any signs that I'm not paying, why should that affect the value of that mortgage you made unduly?
Mm-hmm. Now, I have one last question. It is about the book you wrote called Dumb Money, which is one of the first books out on the market to describe the current crisis we're in. And what it does is I have read a large portion of it, including the first chapter, which is out there online. It describes how poorly thought out instruments were quickly snapped up by the voracious market. But isn't your book the same thing, churned out to appeal to a hungry market, eager to snap up whatever's out there? Aren't you the problem, Dan?
You know, if only I could be compensated at the level of the people who caused the problem, I would gladly accept, you know, 80% of the blame.
So your publishing deal doesn't include clawbacks, you're saying?
No clawbacks. But, you know, it would be nice if actually the government could subsidize the struggling publish industry by, for example, you know, buying toxic remainders that are piling up on the shelves of Barnes & Noble and Borders. I think that could be the next part of the bailout.
All right. Daniel Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, Slate columnist, author of the book Dumb Money, How Our Greatest Financial Minds Bankrupted the Nation. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up after the break, Green Jobs.